Evening, everybody. Evening, Tom.
Evening, all. Hello, Dominic. Hello, everybody. And welcome to the live show.
Yeah, we're always glad to see so many people, an amazing array of people. So I was making a note, Tom, just before we came on air. We've got at least two Rosalinds from Chicago and from Kendall. We've got Jennifer from Adelaide. So Jennifer will be in your neck of the woods next month. We've got Loriana Rosario in Argentina, Lionel Messi's hometown. I think we may have mentioned Loriana before just because I'm so pleased we've got somebody from Rosario in Argentina. Kern from Dublin, Daryl and Carrick Fergus, Sebastian from Sleaford. We've got Carlos and Henrik in from Sweden. We've got a few Swedes tonight, actually, Tom.
That's good to know.
We've got Erin from the Isle of Man. I know you love the Isle of Man.
Love the Isle of Man.
We've got Susie from Brisbane. So again, we'll be in Brisbane this time next month, Tom.
We will.
Brian
and Dominic.
Very good.
If Martha Woodard's boss is listening, who's in Tucson, Arizona, she's got it on her personal laptop while she's working. We approve of that, don't we?
But if the boss was also,
I mean, that's true commitment.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. They could team up, watch it together.
So who else have we got? So special hello to Stephen Clark, because I know Stephen will be very excited because he's a fan of the All Blacks and he been following the New Zealand elections. So I know you'd love all that, Stephen. And a special, special hello to Cody, who has taken the day off work, or at least the afternoon or whatever off work, in order to see this.
Absolute commitment. But Dominic, do you know what else is commitment?
What?
My love of doing live shows is such that I have had to cross the bridge from my Scottish estate to come to England. And so I'm sitting in the office of Ted and Livy, who have very kindly offered me the use of their study so I can jump onto their Wi-Fi.
Joe Evans says you look like a Bond villain.
Well, people say that I look like the Bond villain in the Timothy Dalton one with the media boss and the rimless glasses.
Oh, Fran Sanchez.
Could be.
From Isthmus City, who's smuggling drugs in through oil tankers.
That's the kind of thing.
United States.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, David Muttering, KC, says he looks, says, you have turned up as a roofing magazine.
Pud said, I look like a radio tweed DJ, which I probably do.
Right. Rob Dolby, good news for you, Tom. He says he's got Biff, Chip and Kipper here with him and they'd like a word with you.
What about Floppy?
Yeah, well, Floppy's the key one. And all the others. There's all the other. Yeah, very good, Stephen Clark. So, Tom, you have dressed as the Milk Tray Man. Our overseas listeners will be totally indifferent to that remark, but that's never stopped us in the past.
It's actually, Dominic, it's a naval jersey from the Greenwich Museum, which I bought in when we were doing the Nelson episodes. And I got so enthusiastic, I went to the Greenwich Naval Museum and they had these naval jerseys and I bought one so that I could kind of get in commune with the spirit of Nelson.
I will say this. Henry de Vries quite correctly identifies the fact that if you were a Bond villain, you would be the Elliot Carver, the evil newspaper mogul.
Yeah, that's the one I meant.
Dies, played by
that's the one I meant.
That's not Timothy Dalton. That's Pierce Brosnan.
Is it? Oh,
yeah, you're out of your depth.
I couldn't remember.
Right.
That was now, what I meant.
You will be in your depth, however, Tom, won't you? Because there we are. God, it's actually quite
yeah. Ooh. For you, Mr. Bond.
Yeah.
The live show is over.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tom, just to recap on some housekeeping before you go into your depth, because you are going to be treating us to a monologue, which would be lovely.
It's not going to be a monologue, Dominic. I want you to contribute.
Okay. I might do one of my, this might be one of my Rest of History podcasts where I book a holiday while the other person is talking, as has happened in some episodes. But no. So, listen, we've got some housekeeping, important housekeeping. We next week, this time next week, Tom, we will be treading the boards
in the fair city of Bath.
We will be on stage in Bath. Now, admittedly, Loriano, this is probably out of reach for you. You're in Rosario, no good to you. But I know there are a lot of people within reach of Bath who are not necessarily going to that show. And that is, it's poor form, Tom, isn't it? It's poor conduct. So we would look forward, because you get a free book. Don't come to see the show. Book. Come for the free book. So for the, come to the live show in Bath. Book. There are still tickets and we would be delighted to see you. So there's
Dominic,
that.
I did a show yesterday where the Rest of History book was on sale. So I signed my first copies in the wild. So that's very exciting.
Because you've signed 4,000 copies.
I've signed 4,000 in captivity. Oh, yes.
Yeah. So the 31st, Halloween, we will be on stage at Hammersmith. I think there are a few tickets still available for that. Bath is a different story. It's a sorrier story. Hammersmith is a very heartening story for us, not so much for people who haven't got tickets. And then Australia. And you can go online and see all the Australian dates. Loriana, you could consider flying to Australia, couldn't you?
And New Zealand.
Well, I've yet to get to New Zealand. I mean, I was going to mention, I was going to build up to give the New Zealand the big build up. It's not shameless, Michelle. I do actually feel a bit of shame because she says the shameless peddling always going on this show. I actually do feel very conflicted and guilty about it. I had a dream about the Rest is History last night, as Tom knows, in which I was replaced. Yeah.
By Matthew McFadden, wasn't it?
Yeah, by the actor Matthew McFadden,
who is Tom Wormgams.
Yeah, not by Greg Jenner, the Rest is History. Thank you for that. Now, I was replaced by Matthew McFadden, and he and you were doing a live show in Banbury in the street. So,
and what were you doing? Were you begging to be allowed back in, or...?
No, I was walking through Banbury and you saw me, and you said something to him, and he said, "Oh, there's Dominic." And they were all in this little crowd. And I stress, it was quite a little crowd, turned to see me. And I was really embarrassed and ashamed and looked at my phone and walked away.
Look at that.
And then I got a text
from
Jack.
No,
I got a text from Jack, and he said, that will never happen again.
Oh, God. I think it's a really bad idea to talk about your dreams in the best of times, and definitely not on a live show.
Well, it's the damage is done. Right. Enough of this endless, pointless witter. Let's get down to some serious history, Tom. That's why everybody's assembled. You are going to be talking to us about the Romans. Always exciting, but you've got an exciting sort of sartorial angle. Great. We always love to see that.
Was that from the Athelstan quiz that I failed to do?
Yeah.
It looks good. It looks good.
Theo loves that picture. He just can't get enough of that picture.
Okay. So I want to talk about, really, this has been prompted by the fact that, slightly tangentially, but even so, the Emperor Hadrian has been in the news recently. One in a very kind of light way, one in it couldn't be a more serious way. So the lighter one, and Dominic, this featured in the Athelstan quiz, didn't it? A tree has been cut down next to Hadrian's Wall. And it's famous, isn't it, Dominic? Why is it famous? Even for people who haven't been to Hadrian's Wall?
It's like a really nice tree. Looks like...
Yeah, but what film is it in?
Oh, it's in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
And
doesn't he get to the tree just after he gets off the ship?
So he jumps off the White Cliffs of Dover. He goes to the Hadrian's Wall, and then he goes to Nottingham, which, for anyone with even a passing familiarity with the geography of, the geography of England it's not the quickest route.
Put 2602's comments is very good here. That's all I've got to say. Continue, Tom. Continue.
I don't think so. I think I'm the wrong end for that, aren't I?
Continue, please, Tom.
All right. Okay. Anyway, so and this reflects the fact that Hadrian, of course, came to Britain in AD 122, and he ordered the wall that would be named after him. And there are portrait busts of Hadrian that you get in the province of Britannia. So just, Theo, if we could have the first one. This is currently in the British Museum. It hasn't been nicked. It's there to be seen in its full glory. It was found in the Thames by London Bridge. So presumably this was from a statue that stood in the provincial capital of Britannia, Londinium, what's now London. And Britain, of course, is the far end of the empire. It's far from the civilized heart of the great garden of the Roman world. But there is another portrait bust that is that evokes all the horror and tragedy that is going on at the moment in Israel. So, Theo, if we could have the next one. So this is this was found in a legionary base in what was then Judea, is now Israel. And the role that Hadrian plays in the ongoing tragedy of Israel and Palestine is that Hadrian is emperor. He's ruling over a shattered province. The city of Jerusalem had been destroyed by Roman armies decades before in AD 70 by Titus, who goes on to become the emperor who inaugurates the Colosseum. And Jerusalem itself is left absolutely in ruins. Only a few towers are left, and a legionary is stationed there to keep guard over it. The people of Judea are obviously very restless. They're hopeful that Hadrian might perhaps give them license to rebuild their ruined city, their ruined temple. And when he arrives in Judea, there are seems to have been Judean leaders who actively hope that this would be the case. But Hadrian does not do this. Instead, I think buoyed by the fact that he has been successfully integrating Greek and Roman culture in Greece, he tries to do the same in Judea. And so he does order the site of Jerusalem to be renovated, but he does not allow it to be rebuilt as a Judean capital. Instead, he wants to rebuild it as a colonia, a colony, which is a colonia for the Romans is a transplantation of Roman culture to distant provinces. So a little bit, I guess, like kind of US air bases in Afghanistan, something like that. It's a place where people speak Latin, where the temples are all to Roman gods, the customs are all Roman. And I think Hadrian does this with the best of motives. He thinks it's a way of reconciling the Judeans to the reality of what Rome has to offer. But he offers it, he gives it a terribly insulting name. So he calls it Aelia Capitolina. So Aelius is Hadrian's family name. Capitolina derives from the temple of Jupiter on the Capitol in Rome, the holiest temple in the whole of the Roman world. So effectively, it's kind of like he's calling what had been Jerusalem Hadrian Jupiter. And the impact of this on the Judeans, as you can imagine, is devastating. And right. It inspires a kind of grumbling, low-level insurgency that is part, and the insurgents, you know, they're operating kind of under the radar. They are digging tunnels, they're storing weapons in these tunnels, they are launching the occasional terrorist attack. Hadrian goes to Alexandria, he then goes back to Greece. While he was in Egypt, his beloved, his favorite, his Greek favorite, Antinous, has drowned in the Nile, and Hadrian sees a star in the sky, and this star, it is soothsayers say to him, this is Antinous who's been raised up into the heavens. But for the Judeans, the star is a scriptural portent. It's a sign that the Messiah is on his way, and it serves as a signal to launch a full-blown attack on the Roman positions in Judea. And Hadrian is taken completely by surprise. And he had been relying on the security apparatus that he had as commander of the most powerful military force in the world, that he it never crossed his mind that the Judeans would launch a full frontal attack. And the campaign that he is forced to wage against the Judean rebels is an utterly brutal, utterly destructive one. And the rabbis will remember it in hideous terms. Hadrian is always being associated with the walls. So they say, the rabbis say of Hadrian that he ends up building a colossal wall miles long that is made out of the corpses of all the people that he's killed. And his name will be, you know, is cursed for centuries and centuries to come. And Hadrian himself seems to have been both humiliated and embarrassed by the whole affair. And at the end of it, the measure of the destruction is that the very name of Judea is erased from the map, and it's Hadrian who gives the province a new name, and that name is Palestine. So it's under Hadrian that the land of the Judeans becomes the land of the Palestinians.
At that point, Tom, how many Judeans are living in Judea?
The Judeans, they are basically forced out of their homeland. So those that haven't been slaughtered are expelled.
Yeah.
They can take refuge in Galilee because the Galileans hadn't risen in revolt. And so with the loss of Judea, the Romans, it's a bit like Carthage. You destroy the metropolis, you banish people from their homeland. And properly speaking, by Roman standards, they should cease to exist as a distinctive people. Mm-hmm. But this, of course, doesn't happen because the Judeans have their scriptures, they have their synagogues, and so they start to become what we might more properly call Jews.
Yeah.
And the center of Jewish scholarship becomes Galilee in the Holy Land. But Aelia Capitolina, this colonia that's been built on the site of Jerusalem, serves as a brutal reminder to any Judean, any Jew, that the holy city has gone, that Judea has gone, and it sets up basically the tragedy that we're living with at the moment. So Hadrian's image in this, he is a warrior, he's a soldier, he's an imperator, he is a commander. But what you will have noted is that both the images, the one in Britannia and the one in Judea, so at opposite ends of the Roman world, they're both recognizably of the same man, I think. Would you say? I mean, you
go back to the first one, Theo? I mean, if you told me they were different men, I'd believe you. But since you're telling me,
So this is reflective of the fact that basically there is a coordinated policy in the Roman world of an emperor controls his image.
Yeah,
in exactly the way that leaders today and celebrities would. And if you go into any settlement, be it a legionary camp or be it a town, you are likely to see the image of Caesar that Caesar wants to be
standardized. A standardized formulaic image, yeah.
Absolutely. And even if you are out in the fields, so long as you have a few coins in your purse, you will still be familiar with Caesar. So if we could see the next one, Theo. So this is one of my own preciouses, Dominic, one of my own. And I bought this basically because I think it's a wonderful image. I mean, it looks almost like a photograph. You could imagine him being snapped.
Quite Victorian looking, I think, his face.
Kind of getting ready to look back over his shoulder. And you'll notice that the lettering is in Greek rather than in Latin script. So this is minted in Egypt, but it's the kind of image that would have been produced in any mints across the entire empire. So again, you can see, I think, that it's recognizably the same person. And I think that we are so habituated to the idea that we know what our rulers look like, that the weirdness of the fact that this was the case almost 2000 years ago, often we're kind of desensitized to it.
Hold on, this is Hadrian as well, is it?
Yeah, this is Hadrian as well.
Okay, I think his nose looks slightly different to this one, but there you go. It's the beard is the giveaway, right? Because he's the first Roman emperor to have a Greek beard. Yeah.
It is the beard. Yeah. Well, we'll come to the significance of the beard perhaps later on. But yeah, so the fact that Hadrian chooses to show himself with a beard on coins, in portrait busts, in statues, is the key thing that enables people to know, yes, this is Caesar, this is the emperor. But the weirdness of that is that it is the Romans who invent this idea that the image, the personalized image of a ruler should be propagated across a vast, vast expanse of territory.
Because I've thought of something. Alexander the Great's successors had portraits of Alexander on their coins, not of themselves, because they wanted to lay claim to his prestige. But the Romans don't do this.
Well, so 200 years before Hadrian, the Romans would have agreed that it was absolute blasphemy for a living person to portray himself on a coin. And one of the first Roman to do this, deliberately to portray himself on a coin minted in Rome, is Julius Caesar. Mm. And he does this a couple of months before the Ides of March.
So it's a sign of his megalomania, Tom, is it?
That is how it's interpreted.
Yeah,
and it obviously doesn't go down well at all.
No.
Caesar is murdered, and it precipitates the great cycle of civil wars that culminates in the emergence as single ruler of the empire of Augustus, Caesar's adopted son, with whom everything changes. So the idea of promoting your own image, this is this along with so much is what changes with Augustus, because Augustus has no reservations about this at all. So what was on the coinage before that, you could choose to put in it what you wanted. So you could put on images of the gods, you could put on symbols of temples or the Roman people or animals or anything that you wanted, but you couldn't put your own head on. But with Augustus, because he now has absolute control of all the mints, he can do what he likes. So he stamps his head on every coin. And the result of that is that no one in history has been more familiar to a broader range of people than Augustus. So yeah, it's a staggering innovation.
Because everybody, he's the template for all emperors, right? They all model themselves to some degree. Yeah.
So everyone knows what Augustus looks like, or rather everyone knows what Augustus wants to look like.
Yeah.
because this is the other innovation. So if we could have the next one, Theo. So this is how Augustus portrays himself. And he looks very youthful, very handsome, kind of reminiscent of the Greek god Apollo, who is Augustus's particular patron. And he continues to look like this even as the decades pass. Right. Okay. So Jake is absolutely right. So even when Augustus is kind of lined and wrinkled and gray and balding, he continues to be portrayed like this. But as Jake has just said, this is very unusual because this is normal. If Theo, if we have the next one, this is normally.
That's Vespasian, is it? Is that Vespasian?
No. So this is very much the tradition of portrait bust that you would get before Augustus. Dignified Romans love to portray themselves like this. This is so evocative of the utter contempt that the Romans felt for youth, which as I get older, I come to have more and more sympathy with.
Of course, yeah.
And part of the reason for that is that age allows you to run for office under the Republic. So when you turn 40, you can become consul. So for us, it's all a bit depressing turning 40. But for Roman, it's brilliant. Now I can become consul. And age is associated with experience, and experience is associated with dignitas and all the qualities that a Roman wants. So what's interesting about this, Dominic, is that this is actually a portrait bust that dates from the time of Nero. So that's almost 100 years after the murder of Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And it suggests that that kind of Republican tradition still has traction. There are still people who feel that there is purchase in looking unbelievably old.
So who is this? A senator of some kind?
We don't know. It's some senator or some dignitary. It may be a copy or it may be an original, we don't know, but it's a consciously retro looking image. And it suggests how it's not just emperors who are making play with their image, because to consciously hark back to a kind of style of portraiture that's 100 years old is saying that Romans are actually pretty sophisticated when it comes to correcting their images. It's the, you know, you're doctoring your photos on Instagram or whatever. This is kind of what the Romans are doing. Yeah. Well, yes. So it's very much the look of someone who wouldn't approve of Nero. And if we could have Nero up next.
Yeah, he is terrible.
So here is the scamp.
That beard that goes under his chin but not on his chin. Yeah, chin strap beard. It's unforgivable. Actually, he's got a mullet going on as well, Tom. Am I wrong?
You are not wrong. He absolutely does have a mullet. And the mullet, of course, is expressive of youth because it's young people who wear their hair long. It's quite apart from being a fashion faux pas. It's an indicator from Nero that he is, you know, that he is drawing on that tradition of looking like Augustus, looking like someone very young. But at the same time, Nero is also drawing on the Republican traditions. So, and this will, I think, be clearer if we look at the next image, which is probably, you know, I'm sure you will all have seen these artists kind of recreate them. I think this is brilliant. I mean, this is the kind of guy who would spend a fortune on a debenture at the Rugby World Cup, wouldn't he? And then.
Would he?
Oh, I think so.
I don't think so.
Oh, don't you think?
I don't see that man in a gilet, Tom. I don't see that man in a gilet. And
come on, England.
No, no, no.
What do you think he looks like then?
I've seen men like him outside fish and chip shops.
No, I don't think so. I think he looks very, he looks kind of brutally posh.
Actually, Hal Marcus has got it. He looks like a hobbit. He looks like a hobbit from the Rings of Power. You know, the Amazon series.
No, I think he looks like because he's got the sneer of Cold Command, I think.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
I think that looks like one of the worst men who's ever lived.
Well, I'm not disputing that.
Oh, I thought you loved Nero, Tom.
Well, I love his terribleness.
Yeah, you tripped.
I love his awfulness.
No, you tripped yourself up there. Anyway,
so anyway, the salient fact on this, Dominic, is that his hair is bronze coloured, orange coloured. He's a ginger. Yeah, he looks like a bully from a Pixar movie. He does look like a bully. I mean, I think that's the salient fact. But his orange hair.
I'm reading some of those comments. They're very funny. Teddy, I've been to Wigan, and not everybody looked like that. Go on, Tom.
So, the bronze beard is an allusion to the family name that Nero's father had. So, Nero can claim descent from Augustus via his mother. So hence the unapologetic evocation of youth, but he can claim descent by his father from a very venerable Republican dynasty, the Ahenobarbi, which means the bronze beards. So what Nero is doing here is basically mixing up the palette. So he's got a little bit of Augustus, a little bit of youth. He's got a little bit of the Republic. He's got a little bit of ancestral lineage, and he's blending them and pooling them and making play with them. And he does this very, very effectively because Nero is very, very good at self-promotion. I mean, there are lots of people who don't like it. Paul Scholes is evil twin. Yes, very good. And Nero is really, you know, I mean, he's very, very happy to kind of push at scandalous limits. So if we could have the next one. So the thing of wearing a mullet, the thing of wearing your hair long, this is from another treasure in the British Museum. It's the Warren Cup, which displays kind of homoerotic couplings. And the boy in the front is a slave. So you can see he's wearing his hair long in a mullet.
Can we just expel Gavin Fitzpatrick from the Rest Gavin of History say? Club, please, Theo? He has shamed himself. Absolutely shamed.
No, that's
himself.
An excellent joke. I don't get it, but I think it's an excellent joke. So what Nero is doing is kind of evoking the long hair of a slave boy, a delicatus, a pretty boy. And that's very scandalous. That's very shocking. But he can get away with it because he's an emperor.
Oh, right.
Or so he thinks. So
he's got a kind of downwardly socially mobile hairstyle.
While simultaneously being emperor. So it's the kind of the mixing up, you know, it's the hint of Mockney, hint of, downwardly mobile.
Like that bloke Kadyrov from Chechnya. You know, the bloke who's Vladimir Putin's, he even looks like him. But that sort of thing about being, you know, being incredibly rich and powerful, yet also kind of dressing like somebody from the streets to indicate your contempt for the property and privileged classes. Yeah,
exactly. And by wearing your hair long, also you are equating yourself with effeminacy. And to be effeminate for the Romans is kind of the worst of things. But Nero, you know, he's so punk that he can do it. He doesn't care. He's pushing at the limits. Now, this, of course, leads to, in the long run, to everyone getting cross. Well, the people who matter getting cross with Nero and raising the banners of revolt. Nero commits suicide. And then you have the year of the four emperors. And basically, the four emperors who in the year AD 69 succeed each other in very rapid succession. None of them, of course, have the blood of Augustus. Nero is the last of the heirs of Augustus to rule as emperor. After him, there is no one left. So then the question becomes, what is the sanction for ruling the empire? And the answer to that has been staring everyone in the face right the way through, but it now becomes absolutely apparent. You rule the empire if you have a large number of legions at your back. There is ultimately no other sanction. But the problem for the Roman world in AD 69 is that you have large numbers of people who can get large numbers of legions, and they all fight each other. So you have this, you know, emperor succeeds emperor, succeeds emperor, succeeds emperor, four of them in the year AD 69. But the other thing you have to do when you become emperor is that you have to promote your image. And the way that you portray yourself is basically a commentary on how you see yourself relative to Nero and relative to the traditions that have gone before. So Theo, if we could have the first. So you couldn't really ask for a guy who looks less like Nero.
No.
This is not a man who'd be happy with a mullet.
That's Vespasian, right?
No, this is Galba.
Oh, right. That's Galba. Okay.
So this is Galba, who is the, he's a very kind of old school guy. He's a cold showers and turnip kind of man. Mm. He comes from a long line of aristocrats. So he has a kind of pedigree that goes all the way back to the time before Augustus. He's very proud of it. He thinks that the Roman people have gone soft. Too many circuses, too much bread. They all need to man up. And this goes down like a cup of cold sick with the Romans.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that within 2 weeks of AD 69 beginning, he's killed in a coup. And the guy who kills him in a coup is this guy.
Otho, is
that
it?
That is Otho. And so Otho is wearing a toupee and he looks very, very smooth.
Jacob Rees-Mogg.
He's a trifle too podgy for that.
He looks like Christopher Biggins.
Yeah, he does. And Christopher Biggins, of course.
Russell Grant.
And Christopher Biggins played Nero in I, Claudius. And yeah. Otho was a friend of Nero's.
They modeled himself on Nero, right?
Absolutely. So Otho had been exiled by Nero off to Portugal. Very cross about this. He's able to team up with Galba, comes with Galba to Rome, assuming that he will be named by Galba as his heir. But Galba, you know, he's a very kind of austere, cold shower kind of guy, doesn't want a bloke in a toupee succeeding him, who's a fan of Nero. So this is what prompts Otho to organize a coup against Galba, which ends up with him dead. So Otho now, with this statue, he's basically saying to people, I'm kind of the heir of Nero. I'm youthful. I wear a toupee. I'm not afraid to admit it. I depilate myself. I'm sophisticated. This is the kind of guy I am. So he's basically saying, we've gone from Nero to a very uptight guy who would never have a mullet to a guy who wants a toupee. And this is the kind of the yin and yang of the imperial succession. Meanwhile, however, Dominic, trouble is brewing on the northern frontier.
If we could have
the next one. So
how I imagined him.
I think this is a really great reconstruction. So this is a guy called Vitellius, who is commander of four of the legions on the Rhine, eight legions in all, massive concentration of manpower, the largest in the empire, keeping an eye on the Germans. And the legions up there think that because we've got the largest number of men, we should be the ones who are naming an emperor. And so Vitellius is one of their commanders. Vitellius had also been a friend of Nero, but I don't think that's what he's advertising here. If you look at the one on the left, absolutely, Jesse's absolutely got it. He looks like a heavy from The Sopranos. He looks like the kind of guy who would be hanging out at the Bada Bing, that kind of thing, eating calzones.
Yeah.
But if you look at him without the flesh colouring, what you get is a guy who's just very fond of pies.
No fonder than Otho, though, to be fair.
Oh, I think considerably. He's considerably larger.
I think it's pretty. Come on, Simon.
He's much more jowly. Many more chins.
He's just older. Otho's smooth.
Yeah, he's a large guy.
I'd back Vitellius in a fight. There's absolutely no doubt of that.
Right. So that's what I think is what Vitellius is trying to convey. He's trying to convey a sense of solidity, of strength, of power. He's a kind of mafiosi kind of bloke. You wouldn't want to mess with him.
Yeah.
But the problem is that. This image is very, very capable of being interpreted by his enemies in another way. And so the stories that are told of Vitellius is that all he does is stuff his face.
Yeah.
Tacitus has a very bitchy passage where the whole of Italy is supposedly made to shake by all the wagons that are bringing him deep fried pizzas and double portions of ice cream and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the image of Vitellius comes to be one. He's very torpid. He's very large. All he's interested in is stuffing his face, which opens the door to emperor number four in AD 69, which is this guy, Vespasian. And Vespasian is, like Galba, he's a hard military man. He'd been part of the invasion of Britain. He had been appointed by Nero to go and combat the Judean rebellion. And he is the person who basically suppresses it very, very effectively. Massive, very good at counterinsurgency. And now in AD 69, he has all these legions at his back. He's got a lot of prestige. People in the commanders in the East are happy to rally behind him. But what Vespasian cannot pretend to offer, exactly, Louise is all over this. So what he cannot say is that he is an aristocrat from the smooth upper echelons of Roman society. He is from peasant stock, the hills north of Rome. Right. And it was said of Vespasian that he had the look of a man who was always straining for a shit. And when this is said to Vespasian, instead of kind of getting irate about it, he laughs, because this is the image that he's decided that he's going to convey, a kind of, you know, the kind of guy that you would enjoy having a drink with. He's not going to pretend that he's aristocratic. Instead, he's going to cast himself as the man of the people.
Well, do you know who he looks like, Tom? He looks like LBJ. Lots of people have said that. Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lyndon Johnson.
So that's LBJ's image, isn't it?
LBJ did invite his kind of Harvard-educated advisors. Well, he made them go into the bathroom with him and sit there and talk to him while he sat on the loo.
Yeah, so there it's all about the toilets.
It is.
Yeah, he does look like
there
him.
There you go.
Yeah. And LBJ was kind of, I mean, he very much leaned into the image of himself as a bluff.
LBJ did, absolutely.
Didn't he?
Absolutely.
I mean, that was...
Yeah, that's his calling card. He's a Texan who gets things done, pragmatic, earthy. He swears, he tells folksy anecdotes, all of that stuff. So it's actually a really, and it's a nice comparison.
So no Camelot, no,
absolutely not Camelot.
JFK glamour,
no.
And so this is what Vespasian is consciously setting himself against as well, because there's no point in him even pretending it. But also, he has every interest in casting and promoting himself as the bluff kind of guy who knows what it's like to have flies buzz around your open wounds in a military tent,
right. Yeah,
that kind of thing,
which, to be fair, obviously didn't, but there you go.
So this is, well, because the word imperator, from which we get emperor, originally under the Republic had meant a victorious general, and this is exactly what Vespasian is. So the imagery this kind of imagery, this self-portrayal, is all about saying he's an emperor, but he's also an imperator in the more traditional sense. And it's brilliantly done. Brilliantly done.
Yeah.
So both, Theo, can we just see what we got next? I can't remember what we had next.
Oh, Tom.
Right. Okay. So Vespasian and Titus, because they have been involved in the suppression of the Judean revolt, can both cast themselves as imperatores. But Vespasian dies in 79. Titus dies soon after and is succeeded by his younger brother, so Vespasian's younger son, Domitian. And Domitian has had absolutely no military experience whatsoever, so he can't really play that trick. So instead, he goes flat out for portraying himself as the mediator between the gods and the Roman people. All kinds of terrible things have been happening: the civil wars, temples burning down, Vesuvius erupting. It's obvious to Domitian that things need to be sorted out, and this coin is very, very solid. So the currency has been debased for a century. This is exactly the same weight as the coinage minted by Augustus. So Domitian is presenting himself as a new Augustus. And so hence the premium on youth and on a luxuriant head of hair, despite the fact that actually Domitian was pretty balding and was very paranoid about it. And if anyone ever mentioned baldness to him, the rumor went he would go into an enormous strop. This actually makes Domitian very, very unpopular. And when he's killed in a palace coup, the senators cheerfully smash up all his statues. But actually, Domitian had been very effective. So he'd strengthened the currency, and also he had mobilized large quantities of legions along the banks of the Danube, ready to attack a people called the Dacians, who have a very rich in gold and silver. They have extensive mines, and they've been using this to build up a vast military force. Domitian likewise has been building up his forces, but he can never take, he doesn't know Antimurray, yes. And actually, again, a kind of good Scottish connection, because it's under Domitian that Rome announces that the whole of Britain has been conquered, and a legionary moves into a base in Perthshire, where it stays for 5 years, and then it gets withdrawn, and Scotland effectively gets abandoned because it has to go to the Danube, and the Danube is a more important frontier than Scotland. So apologies to anyone from Scotland who may be listening to this. And this is great news for Domitian's successor. So he's Domitian is succeeded by a guy called Nerva, who rules for a couple of years. He's significant in Britain because he's one of three Roman emperors to have standalone statues, the other Gloucester. Being so in Gloucester outside the Greggs in the shopping centre in Gloucester. The other one is Constantine outside York Minster, because that's where the Praetorium stood, where Constantine was proclaimed emperor. And the third one is outside Tower Hill tube station in London, and it's of this guy Trajan, who succeeds Nerva and embarks on the conquest of Dacia, which he does with tremendous success. And this hair again, this image is all about Trajan portraying himself as a rough, tough, bluff, no-nonsense soldier. It's the haircut of a military man, despite the fact that, yes, well, it's better, I think, than being portrayed with a receding hairline, which Trajan did actually have, as well as Domitian had. So there is a little bit of sartorial jiggery-pokery going on.
How do you
know
they had a receding hairline? Textual sources.
Because Pliny the Younger, who as a young man saw Vesuvius erupt, he gives a panegyric, a speech of praise, welcoming Trajan. And if he'd actually spoken it, it's been estimated it would have gone on for 6 hours. But he gives edited highlights.
It's like one of your episodes, the rest is history.
And in this, well, wait till we do the JFK tomorrow. In this, and in this speech, he says that Trajan has a receding hairline, but that this is a gift from the gods to endow him with a greater sense of dignity. But in these portrait busts, you know, there's no hint of a receding hairline. Right. And the message that Trajan is broadcasting here is that he is faintly contemptuous of fashionable society in Rome. Instead, what he likes, if we could have the next Theo, is to be out in the camp, being given severed heads by auxiliaries, slaughtering Dacians, all this kind of thing. But if that was all Trajan was doing, if all he was doing was claiming to be a rough soldier, contemptuous of the pleasures of the capital, he wouldn't be remembered as the Optimus Princeps, the best of emperors. That's a very good question.
So these would have been painted in flesh tones. Yeah. The hair would have been painted.
Yep.
So they would have been far more realistic.
Or far more kind of vulgar. I mean, if they're not painted well, then they just look terrible.
So it'd be like one of Saddam Hussein's palaces kind of thing.
Yeah, but this would have been, this is on Trajan's column. I mean, people wouldn't have been able to see these. It would just be a blur of colour. But it's making a statement in the heart of this great marble complex in the centre of Rome that Trajan can afford because he has conquered Dacia and he has grabbed all the gold and silver. So he can come back, he can play at being the soldier, and that, you know, that thrills conservatives, that thrills kind of people who look back to the past. This is fascinating. I mean, the reputation of Trajan in Romania is fascinating.
Henrik, for those people who are listening, he said to this day, Traian is a somewhat common first name in Romania.
And there are statues of Trajan, quite a few statues of Trajan in Romania as well. But even as he's playing the soldier, he is also giving the Roman people what they want, which is he commissions the largest bath complex in the world. He gives them unprecedented spectacular in the Colosseum, and he builds this enormous monumental complex, which is still standing to this day, and in which Trajan's column is still there. So basically, Trajan is allowing the Romans to have their cake and eat it. They can identify themselves as true to the martial spirit that had first won them their empire, but at the same time, they can enjoy all the fruits and the luxuries and the pleasures that their empire have brought them. So it's absolutely great for the Romans. They love that. But actually, Trajan isn't the best of emperors because he goes too far, because he goes off, he gets carried away, he invades Iraq, and in the second century AD, as in 21st century AD, this turns out to be a disastrous policy decision. And Trajan has a stroke. The whole of the East is kind of in uproar. And it devolves on the heir and adopted son of Trajan to calm the whole situation down. And that man is the man that we began with, Theo, if we could have the next run, Hadrian. And Dominic, you pointed out that the salient factor about Hadrian, the salient factor about his image, is that he is the first to have a full beard. So yep. Nero had had that kind of sprat beard, but Hadrian has the full beard. And just as Trajan can pose as a bluff soldier while simultaneously building huge bath complexes, so Hadrian also absolutely understands that the key to, I think, to being a successful emperor is to embody paradox. So what is the beard? So Richard Hindley asking, is he meant to look Greek? Well, what is Hadrian doing here? On one level, he's looking uber Roman, because a beard is what legionaries wear. It's the officers who shave, but the legionaries conventionally wear beards. So Hadrian is offering himself up to the soldiers in the legionary bases as a soldier's soldier, as one of them, yeah. A squaddy. And this is important to Hadrian because he is concerned to demonstrate to the barbarians that lie beyond the limits of the empire his utter contempt for them. And he does this by erecting a succession of extraordinary barriers that are not there as defensive structures, but as kind of screw yous. You are not worthy of being conquered. That's what he's saying to the barbarians. That's what Hadrian's Wall is all about. It's not to keep Picts and Scots out. It's to tell to the barbarians beyond Hadrian's Wall, you are not worthy of admission to the great garden of the world. So this is important to Hadrian, that his military posing, pretty mass produced.
So the question Thomas Cottrell asking. Was a bust like this. So they produced manufacturers, effectively?
Yeah.
Workshops, yeah.
Yeah. With casts kind of approved by pretty much a central propaganda agency. So Hadrian is very popular with the legions. So he can sport this beard and not be laughed at. He is the soldier's soldier. But at the same time, as Dominic, as you pointed out at the beginning of the show, and as various listeners have pointed out since, it's also very Greek, because a beard is the marker of a Greek philosopher. And Hadrian is devoted to Greek culture. He was called the Graeculus as a young man, the little Greek. And he's unapologetic about his devotion to Greek culture. Yeah. so we've talked about Hadrian's Wall. We've talked about the wall that the rabbis say that Hadrian builds out of the corpses of the dead Judeans. But there's a third wall for which he's celebrated in his own lifetime, which is the great wall that he builds around the Temple of Zeus that had been begun in Athens in the 6th century BC and never completed. Hadrian completes it, and he builds the largest statue, with the exception of the Colossus, in the world, in this temple. It's a statue made out of gold and ivory of Zeus. He donates an enormous snake from India as a gift to this great temple, which is kind of brilliant choice of present. And he enshrines it as the center of a kind of Hellenic European Union. Sparta and Athens and Thebes and everybody is it's not the arch, but it's the one with the pillars is the temple. And effectively what he's doing then with portraying himself with the beard is saying, I can simultaneously be a soldier and a philosopher. I can simultaneously be a hard man who is concerned with the limits of the world, and a man concerned with tending the great garden, that it is the glory of the Romans to rule. And yeah. That sense that I think the marker then of a successful emperor is someone who doesn't only control his image, but makes creative play with it. So Augustus had done that. Hadrian does it brilliantly. Nero had kind of done it in an edgy way, and it had ended up destroying him. But no matter who you are, you need to control your image, no less in the Roman world, and perhaps more in the Roman world than today, because really the image
is all you have.
The, That's all you have. There's no other way of communicating with people.
So it's true, isn't it, that all successful politicians, you talked about the Romans wanting to embody paradoxes, but all successful politicians do. They embody kind of contradictions, and they present complicated political personae.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true of, you know, the people we talked about, the rest is history, Churchill, Reagan, Kennedy, who we're going to do, all these characters. But I guess nobody else has to do it purely through the medium of either the coin or the bust. Because am I right in thinking that's all they have? They don't use mosaics or frescoes or anything like that?
We don't know. I think that seeing statues of emperors in settlements, and even more having coins in your purse, would be the way that you would know what an emperor looked like.
Right.
And there is no other way. I mean, of course, emperors give speeches. You know, so Hadrian delivers a talk to a legionary base in Africa that is recorded, and that's how we know about it. So presumably this is going on. But, you know, these are very small audiences. Most people can't even read. So the fact that Roman rulers are able to propagate their images this successfully is astounding. So Jesse asking, would these busts be a target for vandalism? Absolutely, if the emperor gets toppled.
So, and then you just replace him with the last head, don't you? With the next head, isn't that right?
Yeah, so that's what happens with the Colossus that Nero had been building that gives its name to the Colosseum. Great statue, massive statue that stands next to the Colosseum. When it was originally built by Nero, it had Nero's features. But when it goes up, those features have been erased. And absolutely, we have plenty of examples of the busts of one emperor being chiseled and being given the features of another emperor.
Yeah.
And there's a terrible story of Vitellius, the large guy, who at the end of AD 69 is cornered in the palace and led out into the forum, where he's surrounded by people who previously had been cheering him, and now they're kind of booing and catcalling him. And Vitellius can't bear to look up, because all around the forum his statues are being sent smashing to the ground. And so a soldier reaches for his sword and sticks the tip under his chin, forcing him to look up and to witness the destruction of his imagery. So Vitellius has to witness his own cancellation before he gets killed.
And we've all done that. Yeah. So a question from Roland Miners. He asks, he says, makes some, well, it's not a question, it's actually my question that comes off his point. He says, one image to rule them all, from Perth to Palmyra. But do these images, you talked about central propaganda and all that, but of course the reach of the Roman state is far weaker than that of any modern state. So do these images change across the empire? In other words, is the image you present in Britannia, presumably there would be some regional tweaks, wouldn't there, to make it more palatable to that particular audience? Or am I wrong?
I don't think so. I think that they are pretty consistent. Yeah, I think they're pretty consistent. I mean, it depends on, you know, individual artists, individual studios. I mean, they might make kind of tweaks to accommodate to their taste. But the Romans aren't really very respectful of the tastes of provincials. I mean, the one intriguing example is when Antinous becomes a god. There are statues made of him in which he's dressed in pharaonic headdress. But that's because he is associated with Osiris, who's an Egyptian god. But otherwise, no.
Well, talking about Egyptian gods, Rosa asks, he says, Alexander went into regional tweaks, didn't he? And Alexander, of course, did, for example, in Egypt. So somewhere like Egypt, which has a very well-established culture, would somewhere like in Egypt, they make more of an effort than they would, let's say, in Perth?
Yeah, so that there are... there are images on temples, say, of Augustus looking exactly like a pharaoh. I mean, looking like Ramesses or whatever. So, yes. But that's not something that the Romans themselves are controlling.
Paul Porter, who's the audience? The Romans are ruled.
Both. I mean, obviously, the way that the statues are interpreted, the way these images are interpreted, will be different. So Hadrian wearing a beard, if that's seen by legions on the on the Rhine or the Danube, that's going to be interpreted differently to the way that it will be interpreted in Athens.
Yeah. And I notice It's just a complete coincidence, really, that the subject matter of this talk overlaps with your new book, Pax. Just an unfortunate, quirk of timing,
total
isn't it?
Coincidence.
So let's push the story forward a bit. You don't have to worry about finding images of all the later emperors, don't worry. So if we go further forward, there are more beards in the wake of Hadrian. So the images become a little bit more Greek, do they, by and large? Is that, am I?
Well, what happens by the 3rd century is that they become a little bit cubist. So,
right.
And what is happening is that the sense of the center of gravity, political gravity, being in the Mediterranean, a land mm-hmm. of that's indelibly stamped with Hellenic culture, is starting to go. And instead, the soldiers who now sit on the throne tend to be from the Balkans, tend to be from frontier regions. And so by kind of cutting back on, you know, the luxuriating curls or the very delicate features, they're making a statement about who they are that is deliberately designed to contrast with the traditions that had gone before.
Right. Okay. That they are harder, more ruthless, more military
yeah.
men.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then at what point, remind me, we have talked about this before in the rest of his history. So don't write in, Tim G. They, at what point do they change from looking straight on to being on the, sorry, the other way around. At what point do they move from being looking to the side to looking straight on, as they obviously do later on?
I think it's around the time of Heraclius, who is the emperor who defeats the Persians in a great and terrible war, and then has the misfortune to run into the Arab armies that start carving out the caliphate. It's certainly around, I think, around kind of AD 600. I'm not absolutely sure, but I think it's about that time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think that's about right too. So that's the point at which people often say there's been a massive transformation in the culture of the empire.
Yeah.
It's much less Roman, and that's why some people will refer to it no longer as an Eastern Roman Empire after the
But as Byzantium, beginning. Yeah.
Yeah, but as Byzantium. And the coins are often taken as a really good example of that. But presumably there must still have been busts, Tom.
There are. But what happens, so increasingly in Constantinople, so Constantine had raided large numbers of temples across the empire to adorn Constantinople. So it was full of portraiture and portrait busts. A lot of these get destroyed in the Nike riots that we talked about with reference to Theodora, this kind of mass, the most notorious sports riot in history. Did you see the naval, the Nelsonian
Rugby World
officers
Cup. At the Rugby World Cup action?
Having I a punch-up and being thrown out.
I actually kind of enjoyed that, Tom, in a really childish way. So for people who don't know, the Rugby World Cup is taking place in France, and England, of course, the only home nation that have advanced to the semi-finals, Tom, having been written off by all the Celts, and now we're left and they're at home. But anyway, that's by the by. People dressed as Lord Nelson went to the match and behaved very badly, apparently because their hats were obscuring the view of the people behind them. And so they all had a massive
bicorn hats
and got thrown out. Anyway, this is by the by. The sports riots and the Nike riots, and that destroyed lots of the busts.
Not all of it. And Justinian, who Theodora's husband, great enthusiast for restoring Rome, making Rome great again. He commissions vast equestrian statues of himself, and these stand in the great central squares of Constantinople. And as the centuries go by, people become more and more bewildered about what they are. And they look at the, you know, the friezes on Roman friezes, Roman statues, and they tell increasingly weird stories about them, that these are carvings that have been done by necromancers to foretell the future. People just can't really remember what they're about at all.
Yeah. Okay. And so people, by and large, they don't commission. Is it because they've lost access to marble, Tom?
I think the tradition fades because it's a very specific culture that sets up statues, I think, is the honest truth. I think that we are so habituated to them that we don't recognize that. But it's not just in Constantinople, it's also in Latin Christendom, that people just stop putting up statues of great men on horses because partly the Roman culture that generated them has gone. The empire is fading, but also because in a Christian world the focus for veneration is placed on Christ and on biblical figures. It's really only with the Renaissance, and certainly in Western Europe, aristocrats going to Italy and discovering all these statues that are being dug up and kind of fated and celebrated again, they then bring back the habit of erecting equestrian statues as an homage to Rome. And we are the heirs of that tradition. But, you know, most cultures don't put up statues of great men on horses.
No.
I
love a statue. I'm just going to say Anne Neal, Barry G, Mark Kelly, Louise Finlay. I don't see you whinging and complaining in the chat. You just got to play what's in front of you. There's no point moaning about the draw. Right. It's the Rugby World Cup banter, Tom. I know you don't have much time for rugby, do you?
I don't know.
So I can't remember where we were saying, because I was just too busy thinking about shaming some of our members.
Calling them out.
I was, yeah. And you finally mentioned Christianity at 9:02 p.m.
Well, I didn't want to disappoint people. Been a sweepstake or...
Yeah. Right. So, Tom, does that conclude your discussion of hairstyles?
It does.
Actually, do you know what? The disappointing thing is you didn't tell me what happened to their hair after Trajan, Hadrian and co. So let's say the crisis of the, whatever is it, 3rd century, I can't remember, it's the crisis of the 3rd century, isn't it? Those emperors, how did they wear their hair?
Well, if you think of what someone looks like in a very cubist Picasso painting, that's basically what it looks like. Kind of shaved, skinhead, but faintly weird. The proportions look a bit odd.
And do the Romans...
Stylized.
Is this my sort of weird misremembering? Or are the Romans struck by, for example, Germanic barbarians' hair? Does it appear disturbing to them?
Yes. So they don't have a word for moustache. So, yes. So the appearance of... Theodoric, for instance. Theodoric, who the Ostrogoth who comes to rule Italy as king in the wake of the end of the empire in the West, he mints coins exactly like a Caesar, except that he shows himself with a moustache.
Yeah. It's very German, isn't it? The Germans are big on moustache. Rudi Völler.
But Theodoric, very, very Rudi Völler. So Theodoric says that, so there he is. So Theodoric says of the Goths that they all want to look like Romans, but that no Roman wants to look like a Goth.
I mean, that hair is terrible hair, Tom. I don't have any hair and I'd rather be like this than like that.
It's quite off, though.
It is, but it's also very tea cozy or something, isn't it? Or like kind of a...
Yeah. But with reference to what your question about when the coins turn round, mm-hmm. I mean, his face is full on there. So it is a little bit.
Yeah, a bit earlier,
a little bit earlier.
Do you know, we should do one just on coins because I love coins.
Very happy to do that.
Yeah, but not just your same old coins. I don't need to see Vitellius again.
No. Well,
have you got
ones?
A coin of... You don't have a coin of the Kaiser.
No, I don't.
No, disappointing. Well, listen, we could do a coin program where we can bring in all our old favourites and Tim G can then lambast us and say, it's just the old greatest hits again. But Tim, you know how it is. You do
That's
the
what
greatest
people love.
Hit, and people love it. And then you do the new material and they say, rubbish.
Oh, we don't want it.
Yeah.
And talking of new material, Dominic.
Yeah.
People may have noticed that my name, Wat Tyler, leader of the Peasants' Revolt. So I'm busy reading up on that. So that's something to look forward to now in January, isn't it? We're going to do that.
Golly, yes. We've got... So I'm just going to give people a little sneak preview. We always like to do this. Some people may have noticed that some subjects come up every month as coming and never appear. So the new thing, Viking sorcery, the new Viking sorcery is probably the Habsburgs, isn't it?
Yes, which we recorded in July.
Was it even this year? Yeah, we did.
With Eduard Habsburg.
So just to give you a sense of what's coming up, in honour of our visit to Australia and New Zealand, we're doing Captain Cook, or rather the beginning of Captain Cook, because we couldn't fit them all in. So Captain Cook and that first expedition to Australia and New Zealand. We are then doing our mighty series about Cortes, Montezuma, and the fall of the Aztecs, which is a stonking 8 episodes long.
Eight episodes.
Then...
Desiree.
That'll be the last episode we ever, when we can publish the Lithuanian Commonwealth 12-part series.
That will be
you
it.
Know, yeah. But we'll do it. Then we have Young Napoleon, which we have recorded, a very jolly series about Young Napoleon. So Toulon, the siege, the whiff of grape shot, Josephine, all that sort of stuff.
We Napoleon have an Revolution. Episode we've recorded with Zadie Smith, haven't we, on the Tichborne claimant.
Right.
Britain's so, weirdest legal case.
So the
Britain's
longest weird, case,
Britain's weirdest trial.
It's the most extraordinary legal case, in certainly in Victorian Britain, arguably in all British history. So we're doing that. We have a whole series about John F. Kennedy, his assassination, the conspiracy theories, and who we think did it.
We have female popes.
We have female popes coming.
We have Romans in space.
We've got loads of stuff. We've got loads of stuff, and we've got all kinds of exciting plans coming for the new year, which we won't tell you about because we'll probably change them, Tom. So we don't want to.
Just keep quiet about that massive Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth special that we put out for Christmas.
Yes, right. So listen, a reminder to those of you who live within 300 miles of Bath. We'll be in Bath on Monday.
We're not desperate, are we?
No, but I just wanted to. Do you know what? It pains me to see a single seat unsold. I'm a perfectionist, Tom, as you know. Tom will tell you.
You are.
I have very, very high expectations. Thank you. I have very high expectations. So to see a single seat unsold really pains and disappoints me. Okay. Yeah, we are still plugging the Bath Titmus, and we'll never stop. So there's Bath, there's Hammersmith, there's Australia and New Zealand. If you want to stop talking about them.
Oh, look, Danny the Boy, Dog Morgan.
That's get nice. In. That's nice. Right. And on that bombshell, Tom, thank you very much. Dare I say that was a tour de force.
Yeah, thanks.
And I'll see you, Tom.
Thanks all for putting hours, up with it.
Thank within you. Hours to yeah, record JFK. JFK.
Oh, God, darn it. I'm so into JFK now.
Yeah.
Do you know what? It's like reading Hamlet for the first time. Loads of really famous bits that I kind of knew about, and now I know how they all fit together. Grassy Knolls and Jack Ruby and all that kind of thing.
Somebody said of the Warren Commission report, didn't they, that it was the great American epic, that all American life was there. And there's a degree of truth in that. So in that book that we've both been reading, Vincent Bugliosi's account of it is an astonishing portrait, actually, of American life in the early 1960s.
And it is like the great American novel. That's, you know, kind of almost because the ambition of the American Great American Novel is to contain all of American life within it, all class, people of all backgrounds and professions and careers. And it really does have that.
Yeah. Well, Don DeLillo's book, Libra, is a kind of great American novel of a kind. Right. But listen, we've got to go, Tom. We're doing the podcast already.
It's better than Libra.
It is. I agree with you. I agree with you completely. Okay. I'll see you tomorrow, Tom. All right. And everybody, thank you so much for your support.
Okay.
We love having you.
Thanks so much, everyone.
And goodbye.
All right. Bye.